another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter.
Hello, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world and the changing economic times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, folks, you got me on another morning commute. It is, once again, about 60 degrees outside. The sky is blue and the day is beautiful. I wish I could say the same about the financial situation in our country, because that's going to be the main subject of today's show. And I know this is the third one in a row, but I've dedicated at least most of this week to talking about this stuff, because it's what's really happening right now. And I want to make sure that when it's all over, when the smoke clears at the end of this thing, before the real tsunami comes and before the real disaster is over, that you are not fooled or lulled back to sleep by a seeming return of normalcy, because you're going to see that here relatively soon. We'll see a few more big institutions shake out. The big announcements will usually come on a Monday morning, actually a Sunday afternoon, as we've discussed earlier this week, so that Friday amnesia will take over. And most of the people in the country today are focusing on AIG, because AIG, it didn't really fall. It was caught on the way down by the Fed, and we'll talk about that a bit in today's show as well. But basically, AIG failed. If it was your business, if AIG was your business, you would be bankrupt a long time ago. The Federal Reserve Commission wouldn't step in and save your business, all right? So this business has completely failed, even though they're operating a business which should not fail. I mean, as an insurer, they should be in pretty good shape. So, again, we'll talk about that in a minute. What I wanted to talk about at the very beginning of this show, it's going to seem to have absolutely nothing to do with finances and government policy and the Federal Reserve System or anything else like that, is fulfill the promise I made to you yesterday. Yesterday, what I said I would do is that I would show you a lie that's been hiding in plain sight. And one that's been hiding in plain sight for 230 some odd years, at least, minimum, because the people that I'm going to use to expose this lie are the very founders of our country, okay? People like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson that I'm going to expose this lie with. But this lie is not Illuminati, it's not really conspiracy theory driven, it's just an example of how an entire population can come to believe something. It's absolute concrete fact. They trust the sources that provide them the information without question. And if you walk up to them on the street and say, this is not really true, they would defend to the death that I must be crazy to say this. So why am I going to do this? Why am I going to use this thing that's like out of left field to do this? Just to make the point, because I want you to start questioning what you're told. I want you to start questioning what the government says. I want you to start questioning what the media says. I want you to start questioning the things that entrench us into the Democrat Party or to the Republican Party, or entrench us as liberals or conservatives, because that's the main divide that they've driven into the population. By driving that divide into the population, the clowns at the top get to keep doing whatever they want. That you, if I ever vote for a Democrat, they'll come take all my guns. Man, if I ever vote for a Republican, they'll put all the gay people in jail. I mean, that's the mentality that they have us entrenched with. And whenever we start to look at whatever group we associate ourselves and see the flaws in it, we realize that the flaws we've been entrenched with about the other side are worse. All right. So the only way to break that cycle is to understand that what you're being told is not the truth. And the only way to do that is to take something so obvious that you believe in so much and destroy it for you here today. That's what I'm going to do. The lie is that people live longer today than they did around the year, let's say, 1800. That the lifespan of the average person, and I'm going to say white American male, because everybody on this list that I have, just because of the group of people I picked, are white American males. that we as a group live longer today than everybody does. But whenever you look at statistics from the CDC or Center for Disease Control, which is where I got today's statistics from, they break it up into white American, white males, white females, black males, black females, Hispanic males, Hispanic females. They break it up like that, and there's a legitimate reason for that. That's not racist. There is certain genetic predispositions of different races that contribute to either longer or shorter lifespans. That's true based on the numbers I looked at anyway, but. You know, nobody would question the fact today, for very few people would question the fact today, that people live longer today than they ever have in the history of the world. With all our modern medicine and modern medical science, that everything today, medically, is better. You'll get better medical care, and because of that, you'll live longer. And because of that, we've allowed billions and billions and billions of dollars to be scarfed up by the drug companies, by the medical industries, by medical insurance companies. We've allowed damn near a third of our economy to revolve around this wonder of modern medicine. And let me tell you, I'll accept the fact that some of the things that we can do today with medicine are absolutely marvelous, and lives are saved that would have never been saved. But this lie that the average life expectancy has expanded, that everybody was keeling over at 50 back in 1800, is a lie. It's just not true. It's wrong. And what got me thinking about this, I started thinking about the founders of our country, the framers of our Constitution, the names that most of us know, some names we all know, Washington, Adams, Monroe, Jefferson, Franklin, Henry Clay, these guys. And I started just thinking about all the things that they did, you know, when they were involved with the war, how long they were involved in government after that, and going, I just think these people were all over 50 years of age. So I went through and I picked out 20 people at complete random. I tried to pick names that most people would know. A few people, as I started to realize that our, you know, what we teach in American history today is limited and it doesn't really cover everything. There may be some names I'll have to explain to you as I read through this list. And don't worry, I'm going to actually pause the tape, finish the podcast, and when I arrive in my office, I'm going to go ahead and read through the list. I'm not going to try to read this while I'm driving. But I'm going to read through the list, tell you who some of these people are if you may not know who they are. I'm going to tell you, I did not cherry pick this. I just kind of went to Wikipedia and started with George Washington and started, you know, connecting to the people that succeeded him as president, people that were on his cabinet, people that signed the Declaration of Independence. I just bounced around Wikipedia and pulled out 20 names, and every time I pulled out a name, I wrote down how long they lived, because they had their birth date and their death date, so it was really easy. And here are the people that I found, and here's how old they were when they died. So here we go. George Washington kind of checked out early at 67. John Adams made it to 90. James Monroe, 73. John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, didn't quite have his dad's genetics, made it to 80. Thomas Jefferson, about as famous as anybody from our history, 83. Benjamin Franklin, old Ben, stayed around till 84. Henry Clay, he made it to 75. Paul Revere, after screaming the Redcoats are coming, the Redcoats are coming, he made it to 84. John Jay, 83. John Hancock, first guy to sign the Declaration and left a pretty big signature, 56, and he checked out kind of early. Samuel Adams, 81. James Madison, 85. Patrick Henry, he said, give me liberty or give me death. Well, death came to him at 63. John Marshall, who was Secretary of State under Adams, 79. Thomas Paine, who is the guy that wrote the famous words, these are the times that try men's souls. His soul was tried and sent on to the next world at 72. Richard Henry Lee, who a lot of people don't know, he's actually the guy that made the motion to declare independence in the Second Continental Congress that actually made the Declaration of Independence happen. He checked out at 62. George Clinton, who was Thomas Jefferson's vice president, 72. Aaron Burr, who was actually Jefferson's first VP and a Revolutionary War hero, 80. George Taylor, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, among other things, was 65 when he died. And George Rogers Clark, who was our top frontier general during the American Revolution, the guy that wasn't on the East Coast, that was out there running around on the frontier, running things out there, even after the war and all that went with it, he made it to the age of 66. And when I take all 20 of those people and all their ages, and I drop them into a simple Excel spreadsheet, and I added up their ages, I came up with a total of 1,500 years that these 20 people lived combined. All right. Now, anybody that wants to figure out averages knows what you do with averages is you add up all your numbers, and you divide by the total number of numbers. Well, when I divide 1,500 by 20, I get 75. So these 20 people that you can verify that actually lived through the American Revolution lived an average of 75 years. Now, some of them dropped off kind of early. 67 for George Washington, 65 for George Taylor. George Rogers Clark dropped off at 66. But, you know, people like John Adams lived to be 90. People like Franklin lived to be 84. Now, what people would tell you to try to debunk this argument is that, see, those guys were famous, they were rich, they had money, they had the best medical care. Hey, man, medical care around 1800 was some guy coming over to your house and cutting slits in your arm and letting blood flow out of you to get the bad blood out, right? Everybody got the same medical care around 1800. They didn't have health insurance and all this other crap, and all the medical coverage basically sucked when people lived 75 years. But if you go check the average life expectancy, right, just flat number, back around that time, you're going to find that, you know, it's going to be in the 40s and 50s. And you're going to look at those two things and go, well, what's wrong? Is Jack Lyon, did he cherry pick these numbers or what? Well, here's the reality. The reason that so many the life expectancy looks so much shorter back then is because there were so many zeros. See, when you start averaging numbers and you start sticking zeros in them, they bring the average down very, very quickly. Think of it this way. You are in school. You have four major tests for a grading period. You get three A's, and on the fourth one, you get an F. The A's are worth 4 points each, all right? The F is a zero in the GPA. You end up with a 12 divided by 4 is a 3. The best you can do is a B once you have one F. All right, so that zero immediately dropped the possible average by 25%. So what was going on during this period of time? Well, mainly that doctors, midwives, etc. weren't aware yet of how important cleanliness was, and we had a high degree of people that died at birth or died soon after birth, and women that died in childbirth. All right? That is the big medical marvel that we figured out to freaking wash our hands and how to deliver children more safely and how to keep mothers alive during pregnancy that had died in the past. And we don't have the bubonic plague, the Black Death. We don't have, you know, X million number of people dying in wars. All right, because our wars are fought on a smaller scale today. At least in America, we don't have, you know, 500,000 Americans dying, you know, in one war. So those numbers get factored back out. So that's it. But when you get a person to a reasonable age, you know, past the infancy period, and they become a normal human being walking around the planet with reasonable health, those people live 75 years. So I thought, well, man, I've been hearing all this great stuff about the life expectancy getting longer. And let's go over to the CDC and see, for white American males today, what is the life expectancy? 75.2 years. 75.2 years. Your average life expectancy today. In other words, we haven't gained a goddamn thing. It's all bullshit. And that bullshit has allowed us to just do whatever the drug companies say we need to do, believe that we need universal health insurance, and dedicate one quarter to one third of modern economies to health care. We believe that they're curing cancer, they're curing diabetes, and what you're really seeing is that people get sicker more often today because of the chemicals and because of even the medical treatment that we're given. It's a lie. One day I'll do a whole show on this. That's not what today's show about. I just wanted to change a paradigm for you today. I just wanted you to take 1 minute of your time today and look at something you were sure was true, and I can just about guarantee you that if anybody had asked you, if people live longer today than they did in 1800 about, 12 minutes ago, you would have been sure that they did. And I've just shown you that they did not. So, as I go through some of these financial things and talk about some of this other stuff, and sometimes even when you hear from a member of what we call the Tinfoil Hat Brigade, those guys are a little bit too fringe for me, sometimes you even need to listen to those guys, because that lies in plain sight. You went to school, people told you how old Washington was, how old Franklin was, how old Adams was. They also taught you that everybody died young in those times. You taught you the two facts side by side. You believe them both. So what else is out there? That's just what I want you to think about. As we go ahead and go into the financial aspects, the first company I want to talk about is AIG, and I want to explain what really happened here. And I'm going to get even a little bit conspiratorial with this. That's part of why I opened up with understanding lies can be hidden in plain sight today. Okay, what you're going to hear on most of the news channels today, and you're going to even hear it on conservative talk radio, we're going to be talking about a government bailout of yet another financial giant, and should we have done it. I'll leave the whether we should we have done it or not to those guys. They'll do a pretty good job with that, and you can tune in to people like Glenn Beck and all these other guys, and they'll talk about it, and you can call them and weigh in. I'm going to talk about the fact that it's not a government bailout. George Bush isn't writing the check. Nancy Pelosi's not writing the check. Joe Biden's not writing the check. Barack Obama isn't. John McCain's not. Congress isn't sending the money. Senate's not sending the money. And the President's not sending the money. Who's sending the money? Federal Reserve. Why do we talk about the Federal Reserve before we talk about this? Because I knew this was coming. Oh, because I wanted to make sure you damn well understood that the Federal Reserve is not the government. The Federal Reserve is about as federal as Federal Express. It is a private corporation made up of major international banks that controls the money supply in the United States and loans the money to us that we spend at interest. Every dollar is a certificate for debt. We talked about that yesterday. If you did not hear yesterday's podcast, go listen to it before you listen to the rest of this one, because it'll give you a good understanding, and I don't want to rehash the whole thing I just did, 24 hours ago. But that's the case. The Federal Reserve, private institution, is the one stepping in as the white knight to save AIG. Why are they saving AIG when they didn't save Lehman Brothers? Well, maybe because Lehman Brothers is actually part of the Federal Reserve and we're going to be taken care of behind the scenes anyway. That's kind of conspiratorial. But if you look at the structure of the Federal Reserve, you'll see that Lehman Brothers is part of it. So I didn't make that up. But the other side of this is, on the public side, we can't have AIG fail because they're an insurer. They don't just insure individuals and property and stuff like that. They actually insure other financial institutions. We have to prop up the financial system long enough to keep things running to get everything that we want out of it if we're the Federal Reserve, which is to consolidate power and control. Just like Bank of America gobbled up Merrill Lynch, we're watching the Federal Reserve system gobble up AIG. What do you mean gobble them up? They're bailing them out. No, they're not bailing them out. Here's the terms, and you're going to hear very little about this. The Fed is giving AIG $85 billion. AIG needs 80. They're giving them $5 billion extra. I guess they need to buy the CEO a couple jets during his what will probably become his exodus, right? Okay, so he needs a few jets on the way out, maybe a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. Throw them about $5 billion more than they really need. But it's not a gift. It might be a gift for him, and it might be a gift for the people that will take some of this money on their way out the door, but it's actually a loan for all of AIG and its shareholders. It's a loan of a loan, because remember, the money comes at 2% interest to begin with, okay, just by being issued or printed, and trust me, they don't have $85 billion sitting in a suitcase somewhere. They're firing up the presses for this $85 billion to get it in circulation. This will be part of that M3 growth that we don't publish anymore. The total number of dollars in circulation that no one talks about anymore. That's where this money's going to go, in at M3. We won't see the growth for several years on the published numbers, but it is going to devalue the dollar and cost 2% more debt to our nation on $85 billion. Wonderful. But AIG will also have to pay 8.5% interest. It's pretty steep, isn't it? For a company that already just demonstrated they can't manage money. They're in the insurance freaking business. The insurance business is one of the biggest scams on the planet. You charge people more than you will ever pay out, on average. You pay out to the few people that have losses, and you reap the benefits. Insurance companies don't go broke. Here's one that's ready to go broke. Why? Because they played around in the subprime, low-end lending market, and they started insuring crap in risky situations. That's why they got greedy, they got cocky. So they have to pay 8.5% interest to try to save a company that's already in deep crap. What does the Fed get besides 8.5% interest on $85 billion? Oh, 79.9% of the company. That's right, you heard me. In return for an $85 billion loan at 8% interest from money that the Fed simply will print, they're getting 80% of the company. So when the company does hit the tracks, when it does hit the skids, the Fed will divest the other 20% of it and sell it off. AIG's going to do it. Actually, AIG's getting this money. They're going to go do that for the Fed themselves. And eventually what will happen is the Fed will end up owning the whole damn thing, because I'll tell you what, they're not going to be selling off. They're not going to sell off the 79% that the Fed's claiming, because they're going to claim the 79% of AIG that's actually still profitable. See, that whole company's not in trouble. Only certain parts of it. They're going to sell off a lot of the profitable parts. All right, but they're going to keep the core profit parts, and they're going to divest themselves as much of the loss as they can. They'll just absorb it. That's what this $85 billion is going to do. Okay, it's going to absorb the loss. Okay, now the company's solvent. Wonderful. We can just write off all this bad debt, pay it off with the $85 billion, and now we're stable. But now the Fed owns 80% of our company. You own 80%, you might as well own 100%. Think about that. You own 80%, you control every action that company takes going forward. So you've just watched the Federal Reserve seize control of AIG that's in a financial crisis that was largely created by who? The Federal Reserve in the first place. If you doubt that, if you think I'm starting to put a foil hat on of my own, remember the lie that I started out with explaining today. It's in plain sight. The Federal Reserve has been a cause of the mortgage meltdown. Is anybody else in our government, anybody else out there? They've been right alongside of it. They've been suppressing interest rates. They kept spending going when it should have kept going. They've bailed out the biggest companies. They've let the ones that they're willing to let fall, fall. They stepped in and stopped Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac from hitting the turf. They've been here the whole time shepherding this thing, and now they're starting to pick up companies for pennies on the dollar, because basically they just bought a company worth hundreds of billions of dollars for $85 billion. That's what really happened. This isn't a federal takeover. This is an orchestrated buyout of one of the largest insurers in the world for a fraction of its true value, perpetuated by a crisis created by the people doing the buying. Sound conspiratorial? It's not conspiratorial. That's business. At least that's business in 2008, and it was business in 1913 when this whole mess started. And we've been dealing with this crap now for about 100 years, and if you're going to believe the pablum that they feed you from the mainstream media, I can't help you. If you want the truth about what's going on here, I just gave it to you. And that's the reason that you should be storing food. That's the reason you should have a garden. That's the reason you should have financial reserves. That's the reason you shouldn't just buy and hold and wait it out with all your money. Now look, this economy actually works to a large degree. I'm not totally against conventional investments. I have some of them myself. But I sure as hell don't have all my money tax deferred where I can't get to it, leveraged in high risk portfolio because I'm only 36 years old. All right, because that's just stupid. And that's what you're being advised to do, and you're being advised to do that by the same people that can't tell you what I just told you right now, even though it's in plain sight. So consider their advice very carefully before you act on it. And of course, you have to get any financial decision, please get advice before you make it. Don't see me as advice. I'm giving you my opinion, one man's opinion. But what I'm saying is question everything. You'll be a lot safer if you do. So who else should we be watching out for right now? Who else is probably in trouble? And this is probably in trouble. But I'll tell you the people that I keep an eye on right now. One is Wachovia. From what I can see, Wachovia's got real problems, all right? Another one is Citigroup. Citigroup is deeply, deeply into the credit card business, hugely into the credit card business, that no one's talking about yet, folks. And that's the next big drop. I have read and I have heard from people that the credit industry as a whole, the consumer credit, the Visa, MasterCard stuff, all right, the unsecured debt, right now has at least $1 trillion. A trillion. Okay, a trillion. People don't get what a trillion is. Let me break a trillion down for you. To get to a billion, you have to have 1,000 million. 100 million is not a billion, it's 100 million. 500 billion is half, or 500 million is half a billion. 1,000 million to make a billion. To get to a trillion, you have to have $1,000 billion. The credit card people are sitting on $1 trillion of toxic debt. Toxic debt is debt that they know they're never going to recover. It's going to get sold off to collection agencies. They're only going to get maybe 5% of it, all right, to actually pay up. But there are people all over the place. They don't care that their credit's trashed right now. They're not going to pay you anytime soon. They don't have a job. They've lost their home. They could give a flying crap that MasterCard wants $25,000. They've already lost everything. But they're going to tell the collection people when they find them, if they still have a phone, is you can't get blood from a stone, buddy. I ain't got it. I ain't giving it to you. And that industry knows that. Citigroup is hugely vested into that market. That's why they're on my watch list. WaMu, Washington Mutual. These guys got problems, too. Basically, they had their status reduced to junk this week. And their people came out and said, no, we're not. And their stock rebounded almost immediately. So basically, somebody said, you're in trouble. They said, no, we're not. Like two kids on a street. And people believed it. Folks, WaMu's got problems. All right, I don't want to get deep into their problems. I'm going to talk a little bit about them in a second. But they got problems. On the investment banking side, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. You got to keep an eye on those two folks. Trust me, you're going to hear more about them in the future, one way or another. All right. Now, what's the real issue behind all of this? What's the lie in plain sight that's driving all of these problems? It is a little thing called FAS 157, or Fair Accounting Standards Practice 157. This was supposed to fix everything. This is supposed to be the cause of everything. I did a show on this before, but I'll explain it real brief here. FAS 157 basically says that if you're a bank and you're holding an asset, as in somebody owes you money on a property or whatever, that you now have to figure out what somebody would be willing to actually pay you for that asset before you put a number down on your balance sheet. That's as basic as I can make it. So if you owe me $100,000 mortgage, and I'm charging you 6% interest for 30 years, and the total value of that asset, if you pay it in full, is going to be $250,000 you're going to pay me. But if I wanted to sell it to my fellow banker and say, what will you pay for this? All right? That number is what I have to put on my balance sheet. That was supposed to fix all the great bookkeeping, because what people were doing is moving their assets into a category called Level 3. Level 3 assets were assets that, you know, it's just hard. It's just hard to put a market value on these things. They're not usually sold. How do we know what they're worth? I mean, well, we don't know what to do. I know. Let's just estimate the value. Oh, that sounds like a great idea. Now my problem solved. So we just estimate the value. Some account throws a formula into an Excel spreadsheet, drops some numbers into it, and out the other side comes the Level 3 asset value for the bank. So these are just basically all these different debts that are owed to them, their accounts receivable, that they were assigning their own value to. Well, FAS 157 came in and said, no more of this nonsense. All right, you have to do what's called market to market. Right? Mark the product to market. What would somebody pay for it today? What's it really worth? What's its actual value? Just like a stock. All right, you can't say that, well, Texas Instruments is really worth $300. Well, if it's trading at 75, it's worth 75 bucks today. That's what it's worth. You're holding 1,000 shares, you got 7,500 bucks. Right? Okay? You don't have the future value, you have the current value. Sounds, you know, something that, we haven't been doing this. Right? FAS 157 came in last year, was supposed to fix this. A lot of these losses, the financial institutions have been saying, whoa, phantom loss is not real, this is just because of FAS 157. Really? Really? Did FAS-157 fix this problem, or are these people still lying to us? Well, Gerald Cassidy of RBC Capital hasn't called it a lie, but he said something in an article I read that I'll link to from the notes on the Survival Podcast on this show that's really interesting. He said, if you were to truly mark them to market, the decline in value could be so great for them to digest that they wouldn't be able to do it without raising equity capital. And I probably don't have that exactly right, but basically he's talking about all these financial institutions. If you really took their assets and marked them to market and saw what their losses really were, they'd all have to raise money. Wait a minute! That's what FAS-157 says these guys are supposed to be doing. When I talked about that regulation, I told you that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were playing games with that damn thing. Right? Even though it was already supposed to be enforced, that they were moving stuff to level 3 asset column, assigning their own value, and reducing their apparent losses with gray bookkeeping. That turned out to be 100% spot on, and they fell on their damn ass in August, and the Fed stepped in and bought them out. Right? Because that was a seizure, too. That was a buyout. That was a takeover. That was control. All right? Not by Bush, not by Cheney. You guys that hate Bush and Cheney, they didn't do it. Not by Pelosi, okay? Not by the damn Democrats. Those of you who hate the damn Democrats, they didn't do it either. Not McCain, not Palin, not Barack, not Biden. None of the new presidents did it. All right? Federal Reserve, private corporation is who actually now controls these entities. That's what's going on. My bigger issue, though, with this FAS-157 is we look at all these other banks that seem to be doing okay. All right? People like U.S. Bank Corp. They said we were more conservative in our lending practices. We have still a strong balance sheet. Do they? I don't know. I'm not saying anything negative about U.S. Bank Corp. All right? All I'm saying is, can you trust any of these financial institutions' balance sheet when we have an accounting and standards practice that says you will mark all your assets to market, you will not play games anymore, you will not assign your own values, you will have to put a value on your assets that's real, and we have a major economist coming out and saying what? He's saying, gee, guess what, folks? If we actually did this, they'd all be in deeper shit than they are right now. You know, those two sides don't add up. That's a balance sheet with a discrepancy on it. I don't know exactly what it means. All I know is it gives me a lot of pause in considering the future of the financial sector. Here's another thing to think about, that nobody's talking about this, all right? I had to dig to find this to even realize the connection here. Bank of America, who'd they just bail out? Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is a brokerage house. They're an investment bank, all right? Their deposits are not FDIC insured, all right? Your money at your bank, theoretically anyway, if your bank fails, the government gives you back up to $100,000 of deposit money, right? It's insured by the FDIC. That process has largely worked. In fact, it's always worked. Up till now, at least, every time a bank has failed, FDIC has stepped in and covered the shortfalls. Every time, people have gotten their money back. Every time. Never failed. Right now, we're getting into a scary spot. Will it continue to be able to do that? Well, here's one of the problems that no one's making the connection to. BOA is an FDIC-insured entity. Their deposits are insured by the FDIC. They're using those deposits. They're using your freaking money. If you have money at BOA to go in and make this merger with Merrill Lynch happen, they're using money that is insured to acquire debt on money that is not. And the largest insurer at the same time is being seized by the Federal Reserve. Do you not see the way this stuff all tangles together? Do you not see why some of our tinfoil hat-wearing brethren think the way they do? Do you not see now how these things all link together? Let's look at one of them. And I don't want to beat up WaMu too hard, but let's just look at the facts behind WaMu that says, no, we're not in trouble, we're good. Well, the first thing we need to know is that WaMu has, by their own admission, set aside $4.5 billion to lose this quarter. Bad debt. $4.5 billion down the toilet, gone. They're never going to get it back. They're happy because it was $5.1 billion last quarter, so it's going down. So they're shitting less money out the door than they have in the past. So they're happy about that. Let's look at where they're at with option arms, okay? Option arms are these stupid loans that some of you people may have taken. Don't ever take an option arm. These are a loan where you go out and you start out in your first few years, and you pay zero interest or 1% interest or 2% interest, and then all of a sudden, somewhere along the way, the payment goes way up because you jack up to prime rate or prime plus something, and all of a sudden you go from paying 2% interest to paying 6 to 7. And the reason you bought the damn option arm in the first place is because you couldn't afford a payment at 6%, which you were setting yourself up for in the future. That's why a lot of these people are defaulting. Not necessarily because they're subprime. A lot of these people had money. A lot of these people still have jobs. A lot of these people's income brackets haven't changed. That's the problem. They thought they were going to make more, or they thought the house was going to go up in value, and they would just refinance it, do it all again. Some loan officer convinced them that that was an option, right? So they went and tried to do it, and it didn't work out. Well, here's some hard figures and facts that show you where WAMU is with this stuff. First of all, they're going to have 4% of their option arms reset in what's left of 2008. That means of all the option arms out there that they're holding right now, 4% of them are going to adjust up, all right? And that's going to create more shortfalls because those people aren't going to be able to pay them. And most of them are not in a situation where they can refinance because most people in option arm now owe more on their property than it's worth. They will have 13% of their loans, the ones that are left that haven't reset yet, reset in 2009. So that's another 13% of option arm mousetrap waiting to go off and hit these guys in the face. And in the middle of all this, they just brought in a new CFO, chief financial officer. And they're writing him a $4 million freaking check on the way in the door before he fixes anything. $4 million to come take over a sinking ship. I want that job. I'll take that job right now. Guamu, if you're listening, call me up and I'll come do that. That's the situation they're in. You know, I talked about U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank says that their bad loan costs may rise 25 to 28% in the next year. But they also said because they were conservative with their lending, they seem to be in good shape. Well, that's great as long as the FAS 157 thing checks out. I don't know. Right now on paper, U.S. Bank looks like one of the guys that are in pretty decent shape. I still like putting my money into any of their stocks. If you're in the financial sector right now, anything other than hedging it and shorting it, I think you're out of your mind. I'm just being safe with my investments. I'm going to fixed income investments, money, food, commodity. I am not trading right now, and I wouldn't advise you to do that either. Again, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just telling you how I feel about this. Now, here's something we need to realize about these arms. Like I said, some of these people in these arms had good jobs, good income, documentable, good credit ratings. They just wanted to buy more than they could afford. Right, but here's the other side of that. 83% of ARMs in 2004 to 2007 were made without income documentation. 83% of the loans from 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, those 4 years, were given to people who did not document their income. And then WAMU has all these people readjusting up to a higher payment that now can't refinance. And I don't want to beat up WAMU. All right, too much. I'm going to beat them up in the future for one of their stupid commercials. But I'm not going to do that today. But what I'm pointing to WAMU is just an example. Most of the other banks are in the same type of situation. They did the same shit. They've all done this. This isn't about WAMU or Citigroup. They're just particulars I can point out to them, guys, and say, look, this is what they did. All right? Now, on top of all this mess, home prices have declined about 18.8% since 2006. So what's happened is these people have taken loans on a house. They said, oh, that's a $500,000 house. I want to buy it for $500,000. How much you got down? Nothing. Oh, okay. No problem. With all the taxes and everything else and fees, $500,000 house is going to cost you $525,000. I don't have any down payment. That's all right. Don't worry about it. What's your income? I'm self-employed. I don't document it. No problem. What's your credit? Oh, it's decent. Okay, good. Here's what we can do. We'll finance 100% of this $525,000. Don't worry about it. Property values just keep going up. Homes always go up in price. Right? We'll give you the loan. 2% interest, great down payment. Now, it'll adjust up in 3 years, but in 3 years, this house is going to be worth, what, $700,000? You can refinance it then, pull the equity out, and restart the loan at a low rate. Won't that be great? Okay, I'll do that. You wonder, where the hell does a guy that stupid come up with the money to make payments on a $500,000 house, even at 2% interest for 3 years? I don't know, but he came up with it. Perfect example of somebody with more money than brains. Now, what is his house worth today? $400,000. How much does he owe? Well, since he's been paying a low interest rate and making minimum payments and paying interest only, he borrowed $525,000. He probably owes about $523,000. So he owes $523,000 on a house worth $400,000, and his payment is fixing to go up 30 to 40% that he was struggling to make in the first place. What's he going to do? He walks out. Abandons his house. He goes out and uses what's left of his credit to buy what he should have bought in the first place for cash, files homestead there so it can't be seized, walks away and tells the bank, here's the keys, stick in your ass. And that's happening all over the place. And every time these rates adjust up, every time this financial trap is sprung, instead of catching the mouse that it was designed to catch, which is the guy that was going to be locked in and continuously paying, where's it going to catch? It's actually catching the lender. And then by catching the lender, it catches us all in the ass. That's where we're at today. And it's in plain sight. Right? Just like what I started out with about people living longer today. That's why I started out with that. Because all this stuff is there. It's easy for you to see. I don't have inside sources. I'm not being fed information by people that are quote-unquote connected. All right? I'm just looking at publicly available information that's out there and available to you. I generally, whenever I talk about something, cite something, whatever, I link to it. It's on the public internet, right? And I try to link to real news sources. And all I do is I take these little pieces of the news sources and I put them together to complete the puzzle. Because those people don't really hide it. They just report what they see as fact and report what they're told to report. And they put a spin on a story. But they put these little facts in there because you can't make the story without the little facts. You take all the little facts from two or three stories, you put them together, you see what's really going on. This isn't that hard. And what's really going on right now, folks, is the Federal Reserve System, which is a corrupt organization, is seizing control of major financial institutions during a crisis that they themselves have created. All right? That's what's really happening. That's what's really going on today. That's the reality. And anybody with ears to hear or eyes to see can see this. I just happen to have a mouth to speak as well, so I'm telling you. So all I'm saying within this, use caution, continue to prepare. We could see a huge financial breakdown. We could see the savings and loan type situation we had from the 80s. Who knows? This could be the 70s. This could be the 30s. This could be the 80s. This stuff comes and goes, but be prepared for it to be the worst. Make sure you tune in tomorrow for another episode of the Survival Podcast, and I'll keep doing whatever I can to help you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
Makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.